All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gatiss, Judge Sleater, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Theodora Gatiss presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar this morning that are scheduled for oral argument. And we will begin with the first of those cases. It is A230936 in the matter of the civil commitment of Amy Jeongkyung Oh. And counsel, I see that you are both here. You look ready to go. Just a few words before we turn things over to you this morning. We will be recording the arguments today. They're also being live streamed, which is a new thing for the Court of Appeals that has just started this term. But audio recordings are also being made of all of the arguments. And so I ask you to please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin making your arguments this morning so that we have a good record with the audio recordings that we're making. Appellant will have 15 minutes to argue. Respondent will then have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have the opportunity to make a five-minute rebuttal argument. The podium in the center of the room moves up and down, so when you get there, feel free to take your time and find a position that is comfortable for you. And that concludes my remarks. We are now ready to hear from the attorneys. With counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's see, how do we adjust this?
There is a button down kind of in the front.
Okay. Tell you what, I'll just adjust the microphone if,
sure,
if there's
works,
a problem with that.
Sure, that works as well.
Please, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I recently gave a funeral eulogy where the microphone was in the wrong place.
I'm sorry to hear that, and let's make sure it's working for you today.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kurt Anderson. I represent the appellant Jeongkyung Oh. Amy Jeongkyung Oh in this appeal from Hennepin County commitment, both a commitment and a forced medication or so-called Jarvis order. We use Jarvis for short in this subject area. On this appeal, Ms. Oh raises 3 points and then concedes a fourth point if the court reaches it. First of all, point one, we are asserting that Ms. Oh has been unconstitutionally deprived of access to a district judge. Legislature passed a statute approximately 2017 or 2018 that said that you can't go to a district judge if you disagree with a referee. That is in flat-out violation of Minnesota statutes, Minnesota Constitution, Article 6, Section 1. Has been reviewed in another context. The context applies here as well. The courts should simply say, no, you can go to the district court and remand and let the district judge have his opportunity to review it, his or her opportunity. Number two, the trial court's findings of fact taken on their face.
Without Mr. Anderson, before we get to that,
go ahead.
That you didn't raise that issue below, if I was going to clarify.
Right, catch 22. Don't take it to the district judge. We didn't. Am I supposed to ask a referee to decide how she's going to be reviewed?
So the language, the terminology, the statutes, I had not noticed that before, but F refers to notwithstanding D and E, which talks about having it reviewed by a district court judge, references for probate and civil commitment proceedings that, if appealed, must be appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. So there's a review and an appeal. Can you help me clarify why that different terminology? And I'm just curious, have you ever tried under notwithstanding F, which says notwithstanding D and E, to have sought review under the D and E of a civil commitment proceeding?
Well, I think your confusion is very well founded, because if the statute doesn't mean what I just said it meant, what does it mean?
Has the district court ever ruled? That's why I'm curious. Have you, for instance, in this matter, but
Representing an appellant with a 60-day appeal timeline, if I go to the district judge and the district judge says, no, you were supposed to go to the Court of Appeals, have I blown up my appeal time? If the statute tells me to take my issue to the Court of Appeals here, I'm not the most diligent reader of statutes all the time, but it's clearly what it tells me to do. And
well, Mr. Anderson, did you seek a district court review under Subdivision 7D?
I'm sorry, did I?
Did you ask for a district court review of the decision? I mean, there is a provision, Subdivision 7D, that contemplates, you know, a review of a referee's order by the district court. And so my question is, did you ask for that review?
No, we did not ask for that review. Again, for the reason I expressed, which is if I'm wrong about that guess, I've blown my appeal, basically.
But the time frame there is just, you know, 10 days following the issuance of the order. And so I'm wondering how you would blow your appeal by seeking a district court review.
Right. The respondent counsel cited an unreported case called Kraske. I represented Mr. Kraske, and in that case, I did invoke the 10-day review. I did that in another case back then, and I think I may have been the inspiration for 7F, or because I think basically at that point, the judges decided they just didn't want that. But no, I didn't ask for it. I read the statute as saying, take my issue to the Court of Appeals. In any event, even if I didn't, there's a conundrum here. I think that everybody's scratching their heads about it. Under Appellate Rule 103, the court should try to resolve it so that we don't have this head-scratching process the next time around. So we do get some clear direction as to what that statute requires, or if it's unconstitutional, to simply say so, and that's what we're asserting here today.
One problem that I have with your argument is that you didn't seek review and you didn't raise this issue in any other fashion, you know, in the district court before the referee, for example. So why isn't the issue forfeited for our purposes?
Well, that's why I referred a couple times in my brief to the catch-22, okay? If the statute tells me to take it to the Court of Appeals, I take it to the Court of Appeals, and that's what we've done. If the statute needs clarification, that's one thing, but I think the statute's just flat-out unconstitutional. Clearly, the intent here is to take the district judge away out of any substantive review process other than whatever they might do on their own initiative. I don't think the district judge could even call for a hearing on it under 7F. What if a district judge said, Jesus, this looks a little fishy, I want to hear from counsel on it. Under 7F, can they even do that? Or does 7D still authorize that? I do think that the court needs to either clarify the statute and or just throw out 7F. It seems like this is one of those situations where everybody thinks mental health is a panacea. You know, refer people to mental health, we're doing good, this is Minnesota, we lead the nation, so let's not worry too much about due process here. I don't think that's where this should go.
Can I just ask you one follow-up question? I don't want to belabor this point, because you've got others, as you've told us, you've got other issues that you want to talk about.
Sure.
It's curious to me that you said in Kraske and in other instances you took advantage of that 10-day
that
review,
was,
right, but you didn't here. So what would distinguish this?
That was prior to the enactment of 7F.
Okay.
And my sense is that 7F was a direct response. Hennepin County is a big mental health jurisdiction, and I think once the district judges started seeing these things come up, they just didn't want them. There was the Kraske case and another case that a name escapes me right now, almost simultaneously went up to the district court, and wouldn't you know it, by the next year I had a prohibition on doing that. So I read it as saying, don't do that, take it to the Court of Appeals. I don't think that that's a proper way. That gives the referee too much authority. It makes her so that she's not a judicial officer inferior to the district court. She's now co-equal with the district court. And I think that this court has to declare that unconstitutional under Article 6.
Did you provide any notice to the Attorney General's office of your argument that it's unconstitutional?
I did, and with the same issue. I mean, since I wasn't raising it in district court and didn't feel I could raise it in district court, I gave that notice once this appeal was pending, and that is in the appendix, or excuse me, the addendum.
Okay.
I'm prepared to answer further questions about that if you wish. Otherwise, I'll move on. Moving on to the merits of the case. Two issues. Number one, did the referee actually make findings that support a civil commitment? The referee made tons and tons and tons of findings about symptoms. Well, symptoms are one element of a civil commitment, but there also have to be behavioral criteria. I'm sure the court's familiar with that, danger to self or others. And you can read that set of findings over and over and over again, and all you find are a couple of non-committal references. The court didn't say she tried to destroy property. The court didn't say Ms. O starved herself. Court says it looks like the court's examiner cites this. She didn't commit herself on it. It's not up to this court to supplement findings. If the findings are insufficient, it requires either a reversal or a remand. And this doesn't involve weighing of evidence. It just involves reading the words of the findings. Maybe the court sees it. I certainly don't see where the referee committed herself to any specific finding as to danger to self or others.
Although there were expert witnesses who provided that opinion, which the referee found to be credible.
Well, an expert witness provides an opinion and is competent then to state those opinions and conclusions. Assumed facts in any case involving an expert witness, whether it's this or whether it's a car accident or whether it's a real estate valuation, assumed facts are merely an explanation of the expert's opinion. Those facts are subject to independent proof. And if there's no independent proof or independent finding, merely saying, well, the examiner considered this, is not sufficient. Moving on to the actual, let's assume now for the sake of argument, the court says, well, the findings are sufficient. The question is, are they supported by the evidence? And here's where we do get to the clear and convincing standard. Reviewed in light of clearly erroneous standard. Clearly erroneous is a very lenient standard, but it's not toothless. What do we have that supports two possible elements of danger? Number one, did she break her car's windows? Basically, we have nothing other than rumor and a strong denial by her on the record. And number two, did she inadequately nourish herself? Well, what does the evidence show? Hennepin County Medical Center records show that she has a body mass index of 26 on admission. 26 is considered slightly obese. That's a judicially noticeable fact, I believe, based on national health standards. Some talk about how she liked to feed her cats, and toward the end of the month, she'd have to scrimp on meals or miss skip a meal toward the end of the month. Is that the equivalent of starvation? Is that the equivalent of malnutrition? Is that the kind of issue? First of all, is it supported by evidence? Exactly what meals did she miss? What are the clinical indicators of malnutrition? And keep in mind, once again, when we wrap it all up and look at the big picture and the court steps back, whether this all supports a commitment civil commitment behavioral criteria, and whether it justifies a civil commitment, ultimately, whether it meets a clear and convincing evidence standard is a question of law. Specifics can be based on clearly erroneous, and I would say that this is clearly erroneous. There simply is no support for it. But even stepping back then, big picture, matter of law, has the petitioner below established a clear and convincing case for civil commitment? Or is it more a little wobbly one, like let's do something for this lady? I understand the impulse, human impulse, saying, well, it looks like she's having some difficulty, let's step in and do something for her. But that is not the statutory standard for civil commitment. Finally, I did originally brief the Jarvis issue. I think the issue of her reliability is a fact issue that probably would satisfy a clearly erroneous standard And I think the standard for Jarvis is preponderance anyway. So we're conceding that issue. If you get there, we're not going to contest the medication issue. So our points are basically the constitutional issue, the sufficiency of the findings as findings, and then whether there's evidence to support them. Thank you very much, and I may or may not see you for rebuttal.
Thank you very much for your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'd point this court to a lot of the arguments that appellant is making, which could have and perhaps should have been raised to the district court, or excuse me, to referee Skibbe. Here, he stipulated to the examiner's report. This is a 5-page document which details things from the interview as well as a review of the records and does meet the expert conclusion that the respondent, excuse me, I'm used to calling her respondent in district court, that the appellant in this case actually did meet the criteria for commitment because she had an inability to provide herself with sufficient meals. She admits that she went without food, that there were instances where she was not able to afford buying groceries because she spent her money on the pets. And if you look at the details in that examiner's report, which was stipulated to and admitted into evidence, if there was a concern about a lack of specificity, that should have been handled below. That's not something for this court to address because the district court, in affirming the findings of the referee, found them to be enough to meet this standard. Additionally, I would point this court to the issue of whether or not there is a catch-22 here with regard to the constitutional issue. I understand it's difficult to say to the district court you're not giving meaningful review, but that doesn't mean you're prevented from raising that to the district court. And so the state's position is that the constitutional issues are forfeited. If there was a desire to perhaps raise the issue and then create the record that's needed for appeal, then we'd be in a different situation. But because there was not an opportunity to fully flesh it out below, that is not properly before this court and the issue has been forfeited.
What kind of record would be ideal from your perspective?
One in which all of the constitutional arguments are raised and thoroughly briefed. I myself didn't thoroughly brief them at that point, at this stage, which in hindsight, in reading that, I'm not as proud of that brief as I'd like to be. And so I think that then there's a thorough briefing, the district court gets a chance to address it, and then we are reviewing on that record. And that is, not we, this court is reviewing it on that record. I think it's just, you also give the opportunity for the attorney general to weigh in at that stage, and it's not just on appeal where there's a different standard of review. Obviously, it's de novo with anything that's a law question, but I think that there's a proper forum in which you raise those issues, otherwise you forfeited them.
Ms. Lawan, would yes. that, I'm thinking in the procedure as well, would it have behooved Mr. Anderson on behalf of his client to first request review under D, I think it's subdivision D or E, I can't remember, and then wait if a district court decides to review or deny it based on F where it references appeal? Because the terminology is different, and I wasn't yet convinced that it actually means you can't do a review, although I understand then what does it mean, so I understand the deduction. So is that the procedure you think would be ideal for before it would be proper for our court to consider the constitutional issue? There'd be a denial, then there'd be some sort of a, I don't know if it would be a review similar to request to reconsider based on the Constitution, a denial based on F to get the constitutional issue before the court, because it would be premature until there's a denial of a review, I assume.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's my read of the statute as well. And I have to admit, I'm newer to the civil commitment area. My background's in criminal. But in reading that statute, I don't see anything that prohibits you from seeking a review, not an appeal of the referee's findings, but a review to the district court. And if a review is taken and the district court denies it, it's often something that has happened with district court judges, perhaps when the state is considering a state's appeal on a suppression issue. They'll file a motion to reconsider, kind of another, doesn't change the timelines or anything like that, but it does give the court another opportunity perhaps to weigh in on it and perhaps reach the same conclusion, but with the benefit of additional case law. I think that would have been proper here to then bring the review and then to appeal from that denial of review or the order itself, because you'd still have the 60-day timeline, as Judge Hallbrooks mentioned. So I don't think that there was anything in there that explicitly prohibits it, and that might have been a better course. Additionally, with regard to the Jarvis, I understand that that's conceded, but I need to acknowledge that my quote on pages 18 and 19, I referenced the statute, but I'm not quoting it correctly. And so I apologize for that. I think it's a copy-paste error. I just want to own that because I noticed that this morning. So unless there are further questions, I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the civil commitment and the Jarvis order and not address the constitutional issue as that was forfeited.
I don't see any additional questions. Thank you.
Just one brief point, Your Honor. Your Honors, on the issue of the stipulation to the examiner's report, it's in the transcript. You can read it. I think it got either mistranscribed or perhaps I was a little mealy-mouthed. My standard response to counsel, will you stipulate to the examiner's report? And I think you'll see most of this in the transcript is, yes, it may come in as evidence of the expert witnesses' opinions and conclusions subject to independent proof of the underlying facts. Now, I'm not sure that that shows that clearly and cleanly in the transcript, but that basically was our position at trial.
What does that mean?
Well, if I were to give you an expert report that said that my accident reconstruction says if I assume that such that it was 5 o'clock and it was starting to get dusky because it was October, and if we can assume that, if I can assume facts B, C, and D, then I will tell you that I think that the vehicle entered the intersection on a red light. Okay, well. The expert is not a witness as to whether the vehicle entered or any of the other facts, A, B, C, or D. What the expert witness can tell you is if you put all these pieces together, this is what it shows you. And if the expert, if the underlying facts are not proven, the basis for the expert testimony then is not in the record, and the expert opinion is either disregarded or discounted accordingly.
Mr. Anderson, just remind me, what medical support was there for your position that commitment is not necessary?
There wasn't. The examiner supported commitment, and obviously the petitioner supported commitment. So I didn't have a contrary medical expert. We do have the opportunity to request a second exam in the commitment procedure. Rather than do that, I was just looking at the sufficiency of the examination itself. I think, and this is perhaps more personal opinion, but I think there is a strong professional bias in favor of intervening for the benevolent purpose of providing treatment. Mm-hmm. And our job is to be sort of a traffic cop there and say, well, wait a minute, you really do have to prove your case and you really do have to have a foundation for your opinion. And you can't provide your own foundation. The petitioner's counsel has to provide that foundation. If they haven't done it, your opinion has to be either discounted or disregarded.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.